The Laura Murphy Show, episode 58.
Welcome to The Laura Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Laura Murphy Show. I am 3/6 of your hosts. Little fractions there for you. I'm Bob Murphy. With me, as usual, is Carlos Lara. Carlos, how are things up there in Nashville?
Well, they're good. Why do you say 3/6?
Oh, I just like to keep people on their toes, make them, you know, reduce it down and realize it's still 50% or 1/2.
Well, I thought you were referring to the fact that I didn't have any water this morning in my neighborhood, and it was morning, and I hadn't had any coffee yet, and so that's what I thought you were referencing.
I should not have been doing higher math when you're caffeine-deprived. That was cruel and unusual. So, folks, what we thought we would talk about today is just an episode sort of giving the big picture on the world economy, or at least the economies among the, you know, the developed nations, the first world nations, as they like to say in a condescending fashion, because they all are on a similar trajectory where central banks around the world are tightening, or in the case of the Bank of Japan, at least they're slowing the rate of increase, put it that way, in terms of their bond buying program. So, you know, the backdrop here is the Bank of Japan, a story just recently came out that they're tapering their bond buying. So the Bank of Japan, the Central Bank of Japan, is buying lots of Japanese government bonds, but now they've been tapering that, right? So back in January of this year, they had an announcement. Now they just came out with the biggest one yet. It's actually not that big in the grand scheme of things. It's more of a directional issue. So they're reducing their purchases by 30 billion yen. But that, you know, you say, wow, that sounds like a big number, but it's only about $270 million because, you know, the yen to the US dollar exchange rate. Just to give you a frame of reference, in calendar 2017, the Bank of Japan bought, just in that year alone, 58 trillion yen worth of bonds. So that works out to about $524 billion at present exchange rates. So, you know, with that amount of purchasing last year, now they've been slowing again. They announced a mild taper in the beginning. This latest announcement of slowing it by 30 billion yen is, you know, they're slowing it down, but still that's massive life support, where a lot of the bonds issued by the Japanese government to fund their fiscal deficit are being absorbed by the Bank of Japan. Okay, so there's that. But again, they're slowing. In contrast, the ECB, they were on target. That's the European Central Bank. They had originally planned on winding down their bond buying. They were doing 30 billion a month, 30 billion euros a month is my understanding. And they were going to cut that off in around September. They recently came out with an announcement saying, we're actually going to wrap it up by fourth quarter. So people think that means through December of this year, 2018. But they're going to cut it to 15 billion a month. Okay, so technically that announcement was an expansionary one. But in the grand scheme, again, the ECB has been buying bonds all this time, and now they're supposed to be wrapping that up. The Federal Reserve, for those who have lost track, they, you know, started the taper when Janet Yellen came in, and then they actually wrapped up their bond buying program in the fall of 2014. And so, you know, the Fed for a long time has not been buying assets on net, and they were just sort of rolling them over. But then even beyond that, then they really have started actually selling off assets outright. And it's hard to pin down specific numbers. They've been, as of this point, from when they started selling last fall till now, I've seen people describe it as $200 billion worth of bonds that the Fed has actually, you know, gotten off its balance sheet. When I go eyeball the chart, it looks to me like it's more like 160, 170 billion, but you know, what's 30 billion among friends. But anyway, the point is the Fed has literally been selling off bonds thus far, some 150 to $200 billion worth just since the fall. And they say that they're going to increase the rate of selling such that it's eventually going to hit $50 billion a month. So again, so it's sort of a reverse QE. So remember under the QE programs, at the height of it, they were buying $85 billion a month in a combination of treasury securities and mortgage-backed securities. Now they're going the other way, saying we're going to start unloading it and that we're going to increase the flow of this faucet draining off the Fed's balance sheet so that it's going to max out at $50 billion a month in net sales, is what they claim. So it's not there yet, just to be clear, but the point is that's what they're shooting for. So that's the big picture in terms of what are some of the major central banks of the world doing. And you know, they have a bunch of tricks that they've been doing because the Fed was raising its policy rates before this most recent bond sale started. And so we don't need to get bogged down in the details of this, but just to make sure you follow. So what was happening, the way they were doing that technically, how can the Fed be raising rates even as its total bond holdings had been flat from, you know, the fall of 2014 just until the fall of 2017, basically. So for 3 years there, the Fed was just sitting on its bonds, rolling them over as they matured to keep the outstanding total in terms of their assets roughly constant. But yet they were raising interest rates. So how are they doing that? Well, because they were increasing the interest rate that they would pay to banks for their reserve holdings. So again, this was a policy that was initiated, I believe it was October of 2008. So right in the depths of the financial crisis is when the Fed, as I like to put it, started paying commercial banks to not make loans to people. So that's not the way they described it, but that's a true statement. So saying to commercial banks, hey, instead of making loans to your customers, if you keep your reserves parked at the Fed, we'll pay you interest on that. And it was a very modest, you know, it was like 0.25% for a long time, but they've been gradually raising that rate. So that was the method by which they could raise that floor interest rate, right? Because if you're a commercial bank, you would be stupid to lend money out to anybody for less than what the Fed's paying you, because the Fed can create money legally. So, you know, there's no chance of them defaulting. So by the Fed increasing the amount that they would pay to commercial banks to keep reserves parked at the Fed, that was the floor they were raising. And then of course other interest rates would presumably move up in response. So that was the way the Fed had been raising rates without selling off bonds. But now, as they say, since at least last fall, they actually have also been selling off bonds on net. So though that's the situation. I guess, Carlos, do you want to chime in here? I know you've written a lot for the LMR about, you know, the U.S. government's plans. Like they're kind of caught in a difficult spot here where they got these huge amounts of debt that have already been accumulated, and they're planning on running up massive deficits as far as the eye can see. At the same time, the Fed's going to be selling bonds off. And so I know you've done some investigative journalism on what they may have in store to try to solve that crisis.
Well, sure, Bob. I think that there's obviously a lot of different ways to view what's going on. Everybody has an opinion. You know, from my perspective, you know, the wheels turn slow. But as we've been watching the movements of the Fed, you know, ever since the financial crisis unfolded in the fall of 2008, you know, we saw that the Fed, you know, took an enormous amount of money or purchasing of assets in a very short period of time on the heels of the crisis. And all of a sudden, you know, we see that the Fed's balance sheet balloons up to, you know, like $2 trillion almost in a short, very short period of time, a month or so. It had like $960 billion on its balance sheet, and it shoots up by another trillion dollars. And that was enough to spook me way back then. But then they kept at it, and they went for 6 more years, continuing to buy bonds. You know, it's like, as you've described it, quantitative easing. And then they stopped in 2014. So then we saw that the ECB and other central banks around the world have followed a very similar pattern. You know, it seems like once the Fed began to taper off and then quit, the rest of the world started in, you know, with their massive buying. And so they have been doing it up until very recently. Now, what caught my attention last year, about this time last year, was the announcement that came out by the Bank of International Settlements, you know, stating that the central banks around the world were all going to begin to taper back, you know, this quantitative easing that they've been on. In the meantime, our Fed began talking about the unloading of all these bonds that have been on their balance sheet. And you already described the pace of how they were going to unload them. And all I kept seeing was a pretty dramatic event taking place, even though Janet Yellen kept describing it as, oh, it's nothing to worry about. It'd be what we're about to do is be like watching paint dry on the wall, kind of boring stuff. But when you realize that it's a reverse QE, and so there's going to be all this massive unloading of bonds on the marketplace. And then what I just heard you say, Bob, now we've got the rest of the other central banks beginning to stop their quantitative easing. And they'll probably follow suit with the same thing to try to unload their balance sheets. I got to thinking that this is a major event here because the Fed's balance sheet is up to $4.5 trillion, and they're wanting to reduce it down to about $2 trillion over the next 3 to 5 years, at the pace that Bob just described. But I just don't see that the markets are going to sit still for that. There's going to be reactions to it. Now that was last year, and there hadn't really been any price movements in the interest rate at that time. But as you can see where we are today, not only has there been movements in the interest rates, but Chairman Powell is indicating, you know, there'll be 4 before this year is out. And so they are, the interest rates are rising. All this massive unloading of bonds is coming out. At the same time, our federal government, with Trump at the helm there, has come out with a new tax reform, and he's having to issue bonds out in order to pay for all this stuff. So we're going to have a massive amount of U.S. treasuries, you know, on the market. And I began asking the question, who's going to buy all of these treasuries? You know, who's going to absorb all these bonds coming up on the marketplace? So that to me is the picture that I see, or the situation that we're in right now, is where we have all these things that are happening. And it seems to be that mainstream news is not really looking at this as being troublesome. However, there's some of us, like Bob and I, that do see that, no, this is a period of time right now where we may see some very huge corrections. And quite frankly, you know, I'm worried about it.
Well, yeah, that's right, Carlos. I wonder, can you just give them a little taste in case, you know, our religious listeners, meaning those who listen religiously, they would remember this. But for those who are newcomers, remember, I'm just thinking of when you dug up some of the details of possibly how they were going to change the regulatory requirements in order to make it so like the investment and commercial banks that might be able to hold more of these bonds. Like in other words, if the Fed's getting rid of them, they had to figure out where they're going to land. And so maybe they're going to tweak the regulations.
Well, sure. And that's what I began to try to figure out, you know, where are these bonds going to wind up? And I just so happened to stumble upon this Executive Order 13772 that was put up by President Trump. And this is where he assigned the Secretary of the Treasury, Steve Mnuchin, to write up this report. And of course, now this is before we had our tax reform go into gear, but the more I think about this report, it's like a 149-page report. It's turning out to be, in my opinion, like the playbook that Donald Trump is following, because in this report that the Secretary of the Treasury wrote out, he was pointing out that Donald Trump was unhappy with the economy and the financial system, the financial systems that we have, and was pointing particularly to the Dodd-Frank Act and the need for reform of Dodd-Frank, the fact that GDP is still very low. It's not at all like it was back in past decades. So he in effect, was saying that the economy is still very anemic. He was saying that banks really weren't lending the way they should. That he actually was saying that real estate was flat, and that business owners couldn't get enough loans processed by banks, and that all of it was being caused because of the regulation that had been put in place by Dodd-Frank. And so he was interested in loosening up that law. And so the Secretary of Treasury is writing this report, more or less expressing some of the things that Donald Trump is feeling about the economy, and in particular our, you know, financial system, the way it's set up. And so he, in essence, is providing evidence of why certain things need to change. And one of the big things that I noticed about these changes, and of course, what we're seeing now is that some of those changes are now taking place. You know, the report was writing about this tax reform that Donald Trump wanted to put into gear. And of course, now we've had that come into play. That was in the report before it actually happened. The next thing is, he's addressing Dodd-Frank in the report. And here recently, I think last week, you know, Donald Trump signed a bill to actually go in and start changing some of the things that are in the Dodd-Frank Act. And most of you listeners are familiar with these changes because we've been getting a lot of inquiries, you know, over the last month or so, where you've been hearing about these changes and you've been wondering, hey, is this going to affect the whole bail-in and the whole bailout situation? And so I wanted to talk a little bit about that to let you know how that stands. And I can quickly say that Donald Trump, President Trump, really doesn't believe that the Fed and the FDIC and the SEC, that these odd outfits ought to be acting as judge and jury on a failed bank. It's almost like saying in that report that our bankruptcy system ought to be able to take care of that. So he's not a big fan of the way Dodd-Frank now is going to deal with a financial bank that fails, and which we've discussed quite often on our show about no more taxpayer bailouts. Now we're dealing with bail-ins. And so the report that I'm referencing here from this executive order is very clear about that they're not really wanting to change that part of it, even though they're not really agreeing with the way it's set up right now. what they most focused on was, you know, removing a lot of the banks that are currently under Dodd-Frank, and particularly having to do with the amount of reserves they need to raise up or to bolster up their balance sheet. It used to be limited to financial institutions with $50 billion in assets, and now the changeover is going to be with $250 billion in assets. So now we're going to have all these other banks that are smaller than that, that really aren't going to come under all of this reserve requirement that were originally put in place by Dodd-Frank. And so that is going to be one big change, and I'll leave it up to all of you to decide, is that good? Does that make our banks safer, or does it put them back into that vulnerable spot? And, but that is one change. Another change that President Trump has wanted to see happen is a change to the Volcker Rule. Now, that one, and Bob probably can do a better job explaining the Volcker Rule than I can, but in essence, what it means is that commercial banks can't be, you know, involved in the trading of derivatives or involving themselves in any kind of trading where they're using their own assets, you know, to trade with in the equity markets. So there's the Volcker Rule sort of puts that limitation on them. Now, that rule was put in place originally, but it really didn't become effective until 2014. And so these big commercial banks have been making a lot of money continuing to be able to do those things. But once it became effective in 2014, banks now, you know, are limited in being able to do that. And President Trump is going to come back now and completely alter that ruling. And of course, that's a very positive thing for commercial banks. Now, if you've been listening to the news lately, there's some controversy as to whether that removal of the Volcker Rule is really going to help banks or not, because the banks have been doing all kinds of stuff and they're afraid that if they change that law too much, it's going to take in into other stuff they've already been involved in. So there's some stuff going on about that. But the main thing that I saw in here had to do with how they're going to change the way they calculate these reserves for those banks that are still going to fall under the Dodd-Frank reserve requirements for the systemically at-risk banks. That is where I saw the biggest changeover. And don't want to get too much into the weeds of how this is going to work, but the way the requirements for these banks' reserves work is that they had to have at least 3% of their total Tier 1 capital. It had to be at least 3% of their overall investment portfolio. So the Tier 1 capital of a bank is the core capital, you know, and this is what is made up of the bank's common stock and its retained earnings. So that's the core Tier 1 capital of the financial institution. And so this number is then divided by all the bank's other tiered consolidated assets in order to arrive at the mandated ratio. So just to use a simple illustration, let's just say if 30,000 is the bank's Tier 1 capital and the consolidated assets are 1 million, we can easily see that the ratio would be 3%. And according to the ruling, the bank would be adequately capitalized to withstand the shocks of an economic crisis, much like what we had in 2008. So what this report is saying is that they want the calculation to exclude three items from it. And one of the first item is any cash that's on deposit with the central bank should not be calculated into that calculation. The second item they don't want calculated are U.S. treasuries. And the third item is that they don't want any initial margin for centrally cleared derivatives to be in that calculation. And so if you take those three items out of the calculation, what it does in effect is that it allows this bank now to be able to take in more U.S. treasuries into its coffers. And so my conclusion is that this report seems to be working in tangent with what the Federal Reserve is doing with this unloading of bonds, and that by changing the way these reserve requirements are calculated, these commercial banks, especially the much larger ones, are going to be in a position to absorb all of these U.S. treasuries back into their coffers. That is the main thing that I see out of this report, and it struck me as something that seems to be isolated, you know, isolated things going on within what's going on with world central banks, what's going on with the Federal Reserve, and then all of an unloading bonds on the marketplace. But it seems to me that the place where they're going to wind up is back in the banking system.
Yeah, so that's great stuff, Carlos. For people who may have gotten disoriented there, just he was had a lot of information. I want to just stress that when Carlos goes off on these investigative missions and comes back to me, it's, you know, he, for example, the phrase bail-in, which now is commonplace, Carlos was the one who went, he actually read the Dodd-Frank Act, and, you know, which my joke is not even the people who voted for it read the thing, and he went and read it, and, you know, he was the one telling me, yeah, Bob, there's bankruptcy language in this thing, and it's, they're going to do a bail-in, and that's, you know, I heard it from him. He was talking about that in the LMR months, perhaps even a year. I'm forgetting the timeline now, but easily months before, like, Zero Hedge was breaking, you know, story for the insider, get your news here first, you heard it from us first kind of stuff. And I was like, no, Carlos was doing it. So on this stuff, what he's referring to about the rollback of Dodd-Frank, in case you guys missed it, on May 24th. So if you just Google Trump rollback Dodd-Frank, you'll see that on May 24th of this year, 2018, Trump signed a bill that the way the headlines are describing it is that Trump, you know, rolls back major provisions in Dodd-Frank. Also on the element of the Volcker rule, just to explain it. So of course, Paul Volcker was the Fed chair in the, you know, who famously broke the back of inflation, you know, going from the Carter years into the Reagan administration, slamming the brakes on the growth in the money supply so that interest rates shot up. So we've talked a lot here about the personal financial difficulties that both Nelson Nash and Carlos Lara got into in that period with sky-high interest rates that were shocking people. So Volcker was actually the person who was directly in charge of the Fed at that time, and that's, you know, that's what happened there. So anyway, he had always said that, you know what, in order to try to contain or prevent financial crises, banks should not be able to sort of take their customers' funds and go, you know, do, engage in speculative activities with it. And so I'm obviously being vague here just in the interest of brevity. And that's, that element was in the Dodd-Frank Act. So it's not that Paul Volcker, this, in other words, it's not that there was some rule in place since the time of Paul Volcker. That's not what happened. It's just this thing that's associated with him because it was his original proposal that finally got enshrined into law with the Dodd-Frank Act. And now, as Carlos was saying, a lot of Republicans are wanting to get rid of that thing. So the point, though, for you folks at home here is what Carlos has put his finger on that I think is quite clever and insightful is to say, amidst all this noise and the cacophony of, oh my gosh, the Republicans are such free market nut jobs, they want to deregulate, no, da, 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 that part of the what's going on here, the motivation is the people, you know, working at the Treasury, they're not stupid. They have more information than we do. If we can sit here and realize how in the heck are they going to finance all this debt? Now, interest rates are rising, even though they just had a huge tax cut. And so now, you know, revenues are going to be a lot lower than they otherwise would have been. And the CBO is projecting massive increase in the debt going forward. And at the same time, the Fed's now going to be unloading something like $2 trillion worth of bonds. Because by the way, the Fed's not saying they're going to completely go back to normal, but they are saying they're going to unload a huge portion of their holdings. So, you know, who's going to absorb all this? And so Carlos, you know, saw this Mnuchin report saying, and he got the idea, oh, maybe what they're going to do is tweak the regulations. You know, so in other words, under the guise of deregulation to make it so that now there's an outlet to make it easier for these banks to take on the debt. And who knows behind the scenes if they're going to be having pressure applied to them. Because remember what happened with TARP, that I don't know if everybody's aware of this story, but that's the Troubled Asset Relief Program. So that was the fall of 2008, where the government was going to come in and take ownership in a lot of the big banks and to try to shore up, you know, buying their mortgage-backed securities and whatever, those so-called toxic assets. And one or more of these banks didn't want the government to do that. They were saying, no, we're actually fine. We don't need you to come in and to shore us up. We don't need to be capitalized by the Treasury. And it would give a bad signal to our customers. We don't want that. But that would kind of defeat the purpose of the program, because if some of the banks that were okay were allowed to refuse the TARP money, then that would mean the other ones that said, oh, thank you, sir, really were in trouble. And then, you know, everybody would want to get out, and that would cause a crisis, or that would exacerbate the crisis. And so the reports from the people who were in that meeting are that it was Henry Paulson was the Treasury Secretary at the time. And he was like, I'm paraphrasing, but this is the way it was reported. He basically said, okay, well, this is voluntary, but just keep in mind your chief regulator is sitting at the other end of the table. And he was pointing to Ben Bernanke, and this was like a weekend meeting, and saying, if you don't take this deal on Monday morning, this chief regulator is going to announce to the world that you're undercapitalized. So you want to reconsider your decision? So anyway, I'm just saying, in this hyper-regulated financial sector, there's all sorts of ways the government can get big players to do what they want to do, you know, without explicitly having a statute or something. So anyway, that's just part of the background, just to help you make sense of what's happening, so it's not just a complete unpredictable mess, that if we know they have these constraints, it might help you anticipate things that the rest of the world is going to report is just, oh, wow, those nutjob Republicans deregulating again. Ha ha.
Bob, I wonder if it makes sense to post in the show notes page this report. It's a lengthy report, but for anybody that's interested in looking into it, it's only 149 pages long. That's a long report, but it's not like putting the whole Dodd-Frank law out there. But I think that if anybody that's interested wants to look into the report, and you can see that it's almost like a playbook. It's Trump's playbook for what he intends to do while he's in office. And he's given reasons in this report as to why he's doing what he's doing. And so the fact that the Secretary of the Treasury happens to be an ex-Goldman Sachs executive, which a lot of them are, I think it always favors the commercial banks. I mean, that whole revolving door between Wall Street and the government, it's you always get this feeling that they're out to protect the banks, the big banks. And so you will see this very clearly here, that it's paving the way for these banks to wind up with these bonds again. And they're doing it by changing the formula in Dodd-Frank. Now, Trump himself wants the banks to be healthy. He likes that whole idea, because remember, he's a real estate developer. And he goes to banks to get these big loans for his construction projects. I mean, that's what he's done all his life. If you remember back in 2016, I believe I was writing about Deutsche Bank being in trouble. Well, one of the bank's biggest creditors was Donald Trump, because Donald Trump was into that particular bank for a lot of money for a lot of his real estate projects. So Donald Trump favors banks doing well. And so he's opening that door by some of these moves that he's making to Dodd-Frank in order to make it better for these big banks to continue to excel. Now, some of these changes, you would think, are being done you know, to help the banks, but somehow or another, you know, they're under all these constraints. And I mean, that's the way everybody talks about it. But quite honestly, they're quite profitable right now. Commercial banks have been very profitable. If you look at their financials right now, they're doing very well. So all of this kind of doesn't seem to add up very well when you think in terms of what's going on. And I don't know of very many sources that have even talked about this executive order that the Secretary of Treasury wrote out long before Trump even came out with the Tax Reform Act.
Right, right. Yeah, I've only heard about it from you. So, well, that's great information. Yes, we will definitely put those up. Well, I'll also see if we can find, I'm sure there's a podcast that we've talked about this stuff a little bit before. So maybe we'll try to dig that up for the show notes page. So again, folks, you're listening right now to episode 58 of the Lara Murphy Show. If you're, you know, getting this on your automatic feed and you want to go to the show notes page, so that where all that stuff is, of course, if you haven't been to the website recently, go ahead and look at it. It's at laramurphy.com. That's LARA-Murphy.com, where you'll see all the archives of the podcast, as well as all sorts of other stuff, including the Lara Murphy Report, which is subscription based, but you'll get all this breaking news and analysis from Carlos and me well before it hits Zero Hedge. So thanks for listening, everybody, and we will see you next time.
You've just finished another episode of the Lara Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
The Lara Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of LaraMurphy.com are not here and engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.